So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, Man fans. Ollie Man here with the final episode in this series of The Modern Man. We're going to take a few months off after this, partly to see if we can get some funds together to make the show, and partly because, as you will recall from episode 5, I will have a new arrival in my home very shortly who is going to take up a little bit of my time. On that, by the way, bit of news for you. Congratulations to Tom Price. His baby has been born. His son Edmund was born last week. Our final show is an absolute corker, though. I think it is actually my favourite interview of the series. It's with a man who spent 9 years in a supermax security prison in America. And I think by the end of the interview, you're going to be pretty sure that you don't ever want to go there yourself. Ever. A few matters arising from the minutes, though, first. Catherine's been in touch to say regarding Alex Fox's clitoral stimulator that looked like Cyril Sneer. I had no idea the raccoons was shown outside of Canada. That's your feedback, Catherine, on the year's best sex toys. Something about a TV show from the 80s. I was a fan of the raccoons, although I remind you, there really were, it's hard to believe if you're under 25, there really were only 4 TV channels in Britain at the time. Alex G has also been in touch to say, Ollie, I just bought you a beer, which makes me a beer donor. Coincidentally, I am also a beard owner. When you say both of those phrases aloud, beer donor and beard owner, they're indistinguishable from one another, he says. It's like Hugh Jackman and Huge Ackman. Yeah, I think I prefer the name Huge Ackman to Hugh Jackman, but I definitely do prefer the donors of beer to the wearers of beards. If you have bought us a beer this week, like Glyn and Pippa and Caton and Pete and A.T. and Dave and Alan and Gregory and Darshan and Emma and Tom and Murray and Mike, then thank you. Remember, if you haven't, it's modernman.co.uk and then click beer money. Huxley Wang the Schnoodle has also bought me a beer. He, I guess, has written to me to say, Ollie, I am your furriest fan. My name is Huxley and I am a schnoodle dog. I borrowed my mum's credit card to buy you a beer. If we ever meet, then please can you buy me a Barker latte rather than a beer? I am in AA. Long story. So weird. But, you know, you did pay for your shout-out, even if you are a dog. Right, this week, you're going to... That's the sound of my cat, by the way, ringing her bell in the background. It's a little cameo for Coco. Funny we were talking about dogs. Right, this week, you are going to learn how to avoid getting recruited by the Aryan Brotherhood, how to distract contestants on Ready, Steady, Cook, and how to bond over art with a Satanist. I told you it was a good episode. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
Because the gang rule is, if you don't hit back, you're a punk and everyone is going to prey on you.
How to survive inside America's toughest prison.
It's perhaps not very well known, but you can get certain types of penis pumps on the NHS.
And no question of cocks is too hard for Alex Fox. But first, for the final time this series, Ollie Peart is here with the Zeitgeist. Hello, Ollie Peart.
Bonjour, monsieur.
So we're going to be talking, because this is our final episode, not just about the trends of the week, but in fact the trends of the year ahead.
In 2016, you will head out and you will buy yourself a virtual reality headset.
No, you won't.
You will.
Well, if you will, it'll be rubbish.
Well, look.
I've seen them. I've tested them.
Which one have you tested?
The Science Museum sells them.
Yeah, but they're not going to be very good ones at the Science Museum.
Correct. And those are the only ones that are going to be on sale at anything like an affordable price. If you honestly think this is the year that Oculus Rift is going to suddenly become a mainstream product, then you are deluded, sir. Well,
I think you're deluded. I quite like that you think it's just going to be a complete fad and be over in a heartbeat. But there's so much money going into it. Like, people are investing huge amounts of money into it and getting themselves prepared for it in terms of apps and technology.
If something's just clearly a bad idea, like virtual reality is, then it's not going to work as a mainstream consumer product.
Why do you think it's a bad idea?
Whose show is this? Who's interviewing who here?
Okay, so the reason I think virtual reality is not a mainstream consumer product is because I know that I don't want to use it. And I don't know anyone who really does want to use it. Therefore, I just don't believe it's going to sell. Now, is it going to be a product where, you know, the army could use it for training? Yes, obviously. Mm. Is it a product that's going to find itself a niche in pornography? Most certainly. I'm sure Alex will be saying that virtual reality is the next big trend for next year's sex toys.
That's it.
But do I want one? No. Not for 500 quid. Probably not for 100 quid.
Well, you could. There are affordable options. Samsung launched one at the end of 2015 for $99 or whatever it was. And Google have got the Google Cardboard thingy. But there's some big hitters coming out
next
year.
You know how ridiculous you look with a cardboard box strapped to your face.
Yes, I appreciate that. But my point is that there's, you know, they might start off quite expensive, but then there will be more affordable options as the technology progresses. So
what
Oculus Rift,
it for?
Sony are launching one for the PlayStation next year. That's a big one. Samsung are launching another one.
Where I agree with you, this year will be the year that virtual reality has to either succeed or die. It's just that I'm putting my money on die.
It's make or break. So this time next year, we'll come back and we'll see how it's done.
What's your other trend for the year?
My other trend for the year is silent film.
Okay.
Why are you laughing?
Because that's a trend from 100 years ago. So I'm just wondering how that's going to come back.
Well, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because as you scroll through your Facebook feed, I don't know if you've noticed, but
All right. I see
video
what
is you kind of videos. You're not that interested in the audio. There's lots of subtitled content where you can just sort of, you know, scan through it. Mostly news articles, but also sort of, I suppose, infographic-y type things as well.
This is autoplay, right? So the idea is when you're scanning your newsfeed and you don't necessarily have your headphones in or the speakers on, but you start watching video because it starts playing. And you're right, people. There's a new art has come back of people making silent video effectively.
Yeah.
Sometimes with subtitles, like it's actually a video of people talking, but they put the words in subtitles at the bottom.
Well, not even that. Like a lot of them will overlay it over the entire picture. So it will be, you know, you'll see a little clip of whatever it is that's going on, and then it will either cut to black and then have some writing. You know, that's like proper old school movie stuff, isn't it? Or it will overlay over the top. But it's just a weird sort of phenomena that I think is just going to grow and grow and grow and grow.
The two things haven't really combined. The stars of silent film and the Facebook pre-roll video generation have yet to combine. When is Jacques Tati going to do a campaign for Motorola?
It's a tenuous thing, but it's an interesting thing. I think it's something that sort of like crept into our social media consciousness even realising.
No, I think I'm not going to be cynical about that trend. I mean, I laughed out loud when you suggested it. I wouldn't call it silent film, but I think you're right. I think silent video, is you're going to get people becoming experts.
We should make one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people who enjoy this section of the show probably aren't enjoying it from a visual perspective, bearing in mind this is an audio podcast. But, you know, maybe we could somehow try and find a way of distilling it into
try
a video
mime
form.
It.
There's probably an infographic we could do.
And it could be about very serious topics.
Yeah, yeah, I'd like to see you mime the migrant crisis on my Facebook wall. I can see that working. Other trends for 2016?
Health monitoring.
Okay, again, I mean, so you mean like Fitbit, shit like that?
Yeah, it's already a thing, isn't
it? Yeah,
let's face it. But there is.
Let's face it. Let's finally admit to ourselves.
Have you ever used any health monitoring devices?
I have reviewed them, and I think they're fine, but I just don't understand. I feel connected enough. Mm. Having a smartphone in my pocket, that's enough. I just don't want everything. I don't want to put my organs on the internet particularly.
I think it would worry me. I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, and I think if I constantly knew what my heart rate was, I'd think I had like heart disease or something and all these kinds of things. But the suggestion is that 2016 is going to be even bigger for it. People are going to be checking their health left, right and centre and just making sure that they're not dying.
Yeah, but you see, again, I can believe that because although if, you know, really you'd say fitness tracking was the trend of 2014, not 2016, it was nerds and geeks trying it out for the first time, reviewing the product. This is the year that people's mums might get into fitness tracking. If that happens, then you're actually hitting your target demographic because you may say you're a hypochondriac, but you're not actually going to die from a heart attack. Whereas, you know, my mum, she might. So, you know, if she gets it on her phone, then that's the real market, isn't it, for health tracking?
So I bought my other half a Fitbit last year, right?
Yeah.
The sleep thing is just bullshit. Yeah. It doesn't work.
I'll give you a free tip of how to monitor your sleep. If you wake up in the middle of the night, you're awake.
Exactly.
If you don't, you're asleep.
This is the thing. And like, how can
you have that for free, that advice?
Well, this is the thing. It tries to define like the quality of your sleep. How the hell can it do that? It doesn't do that, is the point. Yeah. I think it's just a bullshitty little graph that it turns out in the morning, goes, oh, you had a bit of a shitty sleep last night. You want to sort it out the next day? You know, the technology get better, I'm sure. Will I get one? Probably not.
I'll give you one final chance, Ollie Pitt, to prove yourself as the trend master. Mm. What is your final choice as the trend of 2016?
Simplification.
Okay.
We've actually talked about this before in a previous episode, mm-hmm. about the paradox of choice.
Yes.
So there is a big drive in lots of apps to try and eliminate the barrage of choice that we're faced with every single day.
Yeah.
Because when you're faced with that much choice, people make often bad choices, the wrong choices. So apps such as Google Now are starting to come through and get better and better at making the mundane decisions for you.
Such as?
Well, like where you could go and eat, for example. So rather than it churning out like 101 restaurants on TripAdvisor, it'll sort of say, oh, how about these three? You know, so it kind of just...
And based on intelligent learning, so it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday in January, you probably fancy a Thai.
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's trying to preempt what you want based on your behaviours. And there's a whole host of different apps.
Another way to learn our data to sell us stuff, basically.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But it probably would work, yeah.
I quite like the idea that I'm walking around, my phone buzzes, I get it out of my pocket, and it says, oh, why don't you nip in for a sandwich here? Because I know you're hungry.
It is quite interesting. I know a lot of the news apps that are out there at the moment are designed on the basis that you complete the news. Seems like a ridiculous thing. Like in this interconnected world, there's a million news stories going on all the time, right? As Apple News, for example, proves.
Yeah.
You know, you can just scroll on forever.
It's insane.
Yeah. Right. But a lot of the news apps are like, we're insert name of austere publication. Here are the five stories we think are important for you. And then when you've read them all, you get a little tick like, well done, you've read the news. It's this feeling of like, I've done it.
Yeah, you've achieved. You are up to date with current affairs.
Yeah.
Maybe that's how it will be. You know, just like they'll make everything into this little game, the gamification of life.
And what we'll do here on The Modern Man in Series 2 is continue to condense all of the important trends into this section. So you don't really need to read anything.
Yeah.
Scary, isn't it?
Yeah, well, let's face it, I don't really read much anyway, do I?
Scary, though. You know, it's like the idea that people might get their news from watching the paper review on Good Morning Britain. It's like that, isn't it? The idea that anyone actually finds out what's cool and trendy from this.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Oh, God, that is worrying.
Ollie Peart, it's been a pleasure to have you along for this series.
Will we get a series two?
Give me a second series, you mother. we'll find out shortly. But in the meantime, if people just want to reach out to you, get in touch, get a bit of one-on-one Peart action.
Yes, they can. They can tweet me at OllieEP, OLLIEEP.
Ollie Peart, thanks.
Goodbye.
Imagine being incarcerated inside a super maximum high security American prison. Sean Atwood was, and he wrote a whistleblowing blog called John's Jail Journal, which was smuggled out on bits of paper and posted up to the internet by his aunt, and then got turned into a prison memoir called Hard Time. Nowadays, Sean tours British schools telling his life story with the idea of scaring the shit out of children and keeping them away from a life of crime. This is the version he tells adults.
I used to visit Arizona as a kid, and coming from a little town up in the north, Widnes, in between Liverpool and Manchester, flying out to Arizona was a massive deal for me. You know, I'd see the swimming pools in the backyards and get off the plane, it was so hot, and all these houses that were twice the size and cars twice the size, and that really dazzled me as a kid. So I pledged to myself, after my education, I would go and live out there.
So what was the final impetus for you to pack up your bags and fly across the pond then?
Did business studies at Liverpool Uni, and England was in a depression around that time. And my aunts were like, just jump on a plane, it's booming out here. You get a job really easy with your English accent. And I knew from being there previously, whenever I opened my mouth and people heard the accent, they'd roll out the red carpet.
Do you know the Beatles?
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. You're a goddamn limey cousin from across the pond. You know the Beatles, the Spice Girls and all that kind of stuff.
So it was true, was it? You went there and you got a job?
Yeah, I got a job right away as a stockbroker.
What?
If you've seen Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
Started out in an environment like that.
Oh, what, like the one where he's working in a kind of car park lot?
Yeah, where it was glorified telesales. I mean, stockbroking sounds fancy, but at the end of the day, it is glorified telesales. I knew it was going to be bloody hard work. My first 2 years, I was living off my student credit cards and cheese on toast and bananas, worried I was going to have to come home. But 5 years in, I was the top guy in the office, grossing $500,000 a year.
Wow.
And I had my own staff, secretary, cold callers at that point, and I also had enough money to retire. And I started to see the potential of the rave scene, and I moved over into that.
So talk me through the Arizonan 90s rave scene.
And when I got to Arizona, the rave scene was small, and getting ecstasy was extremely difficult. In the beginning, I started to throw house parties, and I was showing off because I had all this money buying all my mates drugs. And if you're giving drugs away for free, you attract a lot of friends. Yeah. And the local dealers couldn't supply our needs. So then I started to find out where they were getting it from, LA. And then I started to see the business potential of it. And then I applied my business studies knowledge, and it just grew from there.
You became a drug dealer?
I became an ecstasy distributor, I would classify myself as.
How much of your time did that take versus the time you'd spend stockbroking?
Well, I stopped the stock market stuff completely. I had a couple of million that I'd made in technology shares during the dot-com bubble. I started to buy the pills from LA, 500 to 5,000. And then that wasn't enough. And we started to import them from Holland, whereby we were getting up to 30, 40,000 pills at a time per shipment.
How did you get them into the country?
Well, this was pre-9/11. And if anyone tried this now, they would get busted right away. But back then, you could put a lot of pills on an airplane and they wouldn't check it. We would have pills in pillowcases, or they would be screwed into computer towers. And I would send smugglers from Arizona, and they would get flights to maybe France or Germany, because you can't go Holland and back. That's a red flag. Now, from France or Germany, they would get the train over to our connection in Holland. They would get those pills, they'd be putting the computer towers or the pillowcases, putting the luggage, and then they would get the train back over to France or Germany, and then on the flight back, they wouldn't fly direct to America. They would fly to Mexico City, and then from Mexico City, they would fly over to the other side of Mexico where we were based, just below Arizona. And, you know, I had property in Mexico, and I had an operation running in Mexico.
So, I mean, you say that it would be a red flag if you were flying drugs directly from Holland to California, but presumably an English guy who's a millionaire in his 20s, who is, having properties in Mexico and flying in 5,000 pills at a time, that's a bit of a red flag as well, really.
But it wasn't a red flag to anybody, because nobody knew I was doing it. When I was going in and out of Mexico, I was actually an illegal alien. If I'd have got stopped at the border, I would have been thrown in jail and deported. Looking back on it now, from a sober perspective, I can't understand how I'm even alive, because my competitor in the ecstasy market was Sammy the Bull Gravano, underboss of the Gambinos, had murdered almost 2 dozen people. And I had the protection of the New Mexican Mafia, the most violent criminal organization in Arizona at that time.
How can some English guy just wander into that market naively?
Have you ever watched Breaking Bad?
I have, yeah. A lot of people die in Breaking Bad.
Yeah, they didn't die at my... Nobody died from my circle of friends. We weren't responsible for anything like that. We never took it to that level. But all of the characters that Walter White met, because New Mexico is right close to Arizona, all the characters he met were all the same characters I was dealing with.
Where did you think it was going to end?
When you're on the drugs, you never think it's going to end. When the SWAT team finally ended it, you know, I credit them now with probably saving my life.
How did they find you out?
A lot of people gave my name in over the years, and they knew who I was, and they've been trying to send over undercover cops to get us, and we saw them coming a mile off, and in the end, a judge authorized a wiretap, and that's how they got the evidence.
And you're how old at this point?
When the SWAT team came, I was 33.
There's a lot in prison dramas about the first night. Yeah. You know, every prison series I've ever seen, thinking right through to Orange is the New Black now. Like, yeah. The first episode, the first scene, the memorable moment is to the audience. Imagine what this would be like. You're turning your back on freedom. You're putting on this stupid jumpsuit. You're being frisked. You're getting your freedom taken away, and you're being put in a cell. How did that feel?
If you've ever held a little bird in your hand or an animal that's frightened, and you feel its heart just going like that.
Yeah.
My heart was going like that for days.
Shaking.
I was on my bunk. They give you a mattress. It's like a yoga mat. That's how skinny it is. And my heart is just thumping all night long against that mattress. I can't sleep for days. I'm so terrified. Right away, people are getting punched in the face. Blood is getting splattered against walls. People are getting dragged out. Human heads getting bashed against toilets, bodies getting thrown around, seeing people getting carried around on stretchers, you know, some of whom look like they're dead.
And this is in ordinary incarceration.
The remand jail is the jail that's got the highest rate of death out of all the facilities in America. 62 people died around the time I was there. And they weren't big bad gang members murdering each other. Some of them, quite a few, were mentally ill prisoners getting murdered by the guards. One was a blind prisoner who got murdered by the guards.
Presumably you had enough money to pay for pretty decent lawyers. Were you arguing that you weren't guilty?
If you're stupid enough to have money and be committing crimes in America, like I was, the police will target you because the war on drugs is a business model and liquidate everything you've got. So I lost everything I got, legally earned and illegally earned, such as my pension from when I was working in the stock market. Now, I was blessed that my parents supported me. They actually remortgaged their house because in the justice system in America, your sentence length is determined by how much money you've got and who your lawyer is. These poor black people get arrested and they've got no money. I saw people like that getting 5, 10, 20 plus year sentences for small crimes because they just get hung out to dry by the justice system. The racism is off the scale.
And that's genuinely because they haven't got someone articulate defending them, you think?
Yeah, the whole prison industrial complex and the justice system, which is a subsidiary of that, is a business model too. So the police, to fill up all these bunks, find the people they can arrest the most of and make the easiest arrests of, which are the lowest level drug users. And if they want to get the blacks and the Mexicans, because they live in the lowest socioeconomic neighborhoods and they haven't got the money to defend themselves, so they'll get big sentences and keep these prisons full. So all these corporations that get $50,000 a year plus per prisoner can make money off the back of it.
What was your plea?
Oh yeah, you have to plead guilty. You have to plead guilty, even if you've not done it, because they will make an example of you. If you go to trial, if you exercise your right to a trial in Arizona, which only 2% of people dare to do, that costs the state money. So when they find you guilty, they'll give you the super aggravated maximum sentence and stack all of your charges one on top of the other. And it was made clear to me, I had 20 plus charges. If I went to trial and lost, they could stack that up to a maximum 200-year sentence. I saw people get decades for drugs, and I saw one guy get 200 years.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
For drugs.
I got sentenced to the Arizona Department of Corrections. Now, that's a prison system, and they have, I think, 50 to 60,000 prisoners, and they have prisons all over Arizona. And because I was fighting my case the longest, I was at war with the prosecutor, and she pulled a number of legal tricks on me throughout my entire remand period. And her final farewell to me was, I had a 9.5-year sentence, and it was comprised of 3 sentences, and one of them was 26 months. And she'd accidentally put it down on her paperwork as 26 years. So I was fast-tracked to the super maximum security prison in Florence, Arizona in the beginning, which got the most violent, dangerous prisoners, including death row. My first neighbor was a serial killer, and my first cellmate was a Satanist. He had a satanic pentagram tattooed on his forehead, and he was in for murder, part of a cult that was drinking blood and eating human body parts.
Fuck me.
And he was actually very nice to me.
I'm sure he was.
He just read a book about Leonardo da Vinci.
He's probably preparing you for an hors d'oeuvre.
He just read a book about Leonardo da Vinci. And he gave it me and we discussed it. And I didn't have any problems with him whatsoever. And I wasn't worried around him either, because I didn't know what he was in for until he got moved out and the neighbours told me.
Did you quit drugs whilst you were in prison?
Yeah. I didn't take drugs after the SWAT team came.
That must have been very difficult.
No, because I was so terrified that I was about to lose my entire future because of the stupid stuff I'd done. I realised the seriousness of the situation once the prosecutor made it clear. You know, within the first month or so, she classified me as a serious drug offender, which was a minimum of 25 years. You know, down the road, it was a year in when they told me that they were upping it to 200 years. And I'm thinking, you know, I could get high in here, make things worse for myself, and, you know, blend in with what everybody else is doing, or I can get my head straight, fight for my life, and hopefully get out of this situation. And that was, it was pure self-preservation.
What was the worst night that you remember in the high security prison?
The worst night was probably when I contemplated suicide. Okay, I had co-defendants in the first year who were around me and protecting me in the jail. Some big guys, from bouncers from the raves. But I got split from them after a year in because the prosecutor doubled my bail to $1.5 million, which classifies you over to maximum security, where it was nearly all murderers. And it was so cockroach infested that they were just crawling all over us that night, and I couldn't sleep, and I was hearing voices, seeing imaginary cockroaches. I had bleeding and itching skin infections all over my body, and I had a pink eye infection, and pus was coming out my eye, and my eyelid was drooping down. It's almost 50 degrees out there, and it's hot all year round, and you got these infections, and your skin's itchy, but because you've been sweating constantly, your skin turns soggy, and you scratch yourself, and clumps of your own skin detach under your nails. I'd lost over a storm because I couldn't eat this food. Sometimes had the dead rats in it. On and on and on. And they tell me you face up to 200 years. They stopped my girlfriend from visiting me. The prosecutor did. She was my lifeline. I figured, 200 years? Do I want to spend the rest of my life in an environment like this? And I was at the point there where I was just going to slash my wrists and bleed out. And I wanted to do it after a guard did a security walk. And I thought to myself, before I do it, I've got to say goodbye to my family first. And what I mean by that is I was allowed 7 photos. So I'm looking at these photos of my sister, mum, dad, girlfriend, and I'm thinking my mum's going to get a call saying he's slashed his wrist in an Arizona jail cell. And I couldn't bear the thought of my mum hearing that on the phone. Even thinking about it now is making me feel sad, and that's what stopped me from doing it. But I'm not just trying to sound like a whiner here, because the world hates a whiner. You know, I put myself in there by breaking the law and getting pushed to the brink of suicidal madness. I credit now with strengthening me as a person and sending my life in this whole new positive direction.
Well, you see, that's interesting, because then people would say, haven't you just said prison works? And not just prison works, but that kind of prison, which to a lot of people is completely morally unethical, pushing people way beyond, you know, anything that could be called rehabilitation and into severe punishment. And yet you've just said for you that was corrective.
I am the poster child for the jail, but having met the prisoners and hearing their sad stories, I know my experience is an anomaly. Basically, the young people come in. They think it's cool to click up with the gang. They're going to protect them. They're scared, so they go on from smoking pot to getting involved with the hardest drugs. They get neo-Nazi tattoos. The gang knows if they put a swastika on someone's forehead, which is an Aryan Brotherhood tattoo, when they go to a job interview, when they get out, they don't stand a chance. They're going to come right back. Yeah. The prison allows it to be drug and gang infested. They know if they give them job skills, if they give them rehabilitation, if they give them drug counseling, they have a stand a chance when they get out. But they want them to come right back as well. So all the odds are stacked against these poor young people coming in.
Did you get courted by the Aryan Brotherhood?
Whatever race you are, a gang will court you. And because I'm white and that's the main gang, yeah, they come up to me right away.
What did they say?
What are your charges? And they want to see your little charge sheet that is printed out by the jail.
It was like a job interview. Basically, they're checking you're all right.
Yeah, they're checking you out to see if they can recruit you,
yeah.
To see if they can extort you, to see if they can rape you, punk you out. They are finding out everything about you to see where you fit in their world.
But it's not important to them whether or not you're racist. It's just important that you're white and you're not a serial killer.
Well, if you've got a Mexican girlfriend or a mixed race kid, it is important to them, because then they know you're not going to be indoctrinated into the highest level of their world.
How did you avoid becoming part of their world?
I got arrested with some big people, including my best mate, Wildman, who's 25 stone, his nose is pointing over here. And I grew up with him, and he's a good man to get arrested with. So with those guys protecting me through the remand period, I never got attacked. I only got attacked after I got separated from those guys, and that was my third year in. After I got out of the super maximum security prison, I was sent to Buckeye Prison, and it was medium security, and I was hoping they would be a bit softer than the guys in Supermax, but I was wrong. My first cellmate was a serial home invader torturer, breaking into houses and torturing people by taking a ball peen hammer to their kneecaps. That was his preferred method of torture. And his welcoming statement to me the night I moved in with him was, I've got a padlock in a sock. I can smash your brains in while you sleep. I can kill you whenever I want. I'm the quietest cellmate you could ever have. You know, all I do is read and write. And he's like, this guy's a fish, a new prisoner. I'm a convict. Mm. can't stand fish. I want a convict as my cellmate. That was his attitude.
Why? For his own defence, really?
Well, his thing was getting high on heroin all day, and he wanted someone in there who would watch out for him and help him get drugs in, and so they could get high and watch out for guards and stuff like that. You know, I was in there not doing drugs, considered lame by the people who weren't doing drugs, considered a nerd because I was reading and writing by him, and just didn't get along from the get-go. And the two things you look forward to the most in prison are your visits and your mail. These are golden. My cellmate knew my parents were flying 5,000 miles to visit me for Christmas, so he got his mate a 20-stone California biker to attack me just when I'm going to this visit with my mum and dad. Now, I'm walking down a crowded corridor as happy as can be. No idea this has been planned just to spoil things for me. The big guy sneaks up behind me in this crowded corridor and bam, just starts kidney punching me. I'm completely taken by surprise. I spin around, and because it's all happening so fast, I don't see where he's gone. He comes at me from another angle again, and bam. Then the prisoners start stopping because they notice something's going on to see my reaction. Because the gang rule is, if you don't hit back, you're a punk and everyone is going to prey on you. But if you do hit back and the guards see it, and there's cameras here and there, and there's guards in like this plexiglass bubble, then the guards come down and arrest you and put you in lockdown, which is a prison within the prison, and, you know, you lose all your privileges, including your visits. So I had to think fast on my feet. I've got a choice. I can hit back, and then I'll get the respect of the prisoners, even if I lose. Look at the size of this guy. I already know this isn't going to end up well for me. Or I can curl up into a ball and let this guy hit me, and or run off, and everyone's going to see that I haven't shown heart. It's called showing heart. And then after that, that's the door open. Then it's just, you know, everybody just taking advantage of you, taking your food, raping you.
So there is no choice. You have to hit back.
Yeah, you got no choice. I like to think I was brave hitting back, but I had no choice. And it didn't end up well for me. It was like hitting a big bag of cement. I mean, this guy had one of those jaws, you know, that you could hit it, but it was like a brick. So he spun me around and smashed me up and knocked me down. And because it was all happening so fast in this crowded corridor, it could have got a lot worse. But people started yelling that a guard was coming. And I was injured. My back, my kidneys and stuff was injured. I was hurting for about a week.
And did you get any medical help?
Nah, I didn't. If you report anything like that, then it's how did it happen? And then you're a snitch, and then it's kill on sight for snitches. My mum's asking me what's wrong, and I couldn't tell her because she'd already had a nervous breakdown of my situation. So I get back from the visit. Cellmate, he's getting higher on heroin and crystal meth and acting crazy towards me. He's showing me the padlock in the sock that he's going to smash my skull in. He's keeping me awake at night interrogating me. And it was the only time I got so scared I called for outside help. I called my family, said, look, can you put a call into the British Embassy and see if they'll call the prison and get me moved? When these guys call the prison, they can't say anything I've said that will get him in trouble, because then I'm a snitch. Kill on sight. Everyone's going to want to kill me. Fortunately, Embassy handled it appropriately, and I was moved without getting him any trouble. He was throwing batteries at me for a couple of weeks afterwards, until I got a cellmate who was bigger than him, who had some words, and it stopped after that. And that cellmate also then introduced me to two Tonys. Two Tonys was a mafia guy serving 141 years who left the dead bodies of rival gangsters from Arizona to Alaska. So if you've only murdered rival gangsters, there's a hierarchy amongst the murderers. That put him at the top of the respect in the prison. And once he took me under his wing, he knew I was a writer and he was looking for someone to write his life story. And I come along and I was sneaking in his cell every day for hours on end, and he's dictating this story to me. And by the end of it, he said I was like the son that he'd never had. I started a class for the Mexicans so they could write home in Spanish to their loved ones, because a lot of them were from the countryside and they couldn't write in Spanish back to their family members. And Aryan Brotherhood prison gang had a problem with that because I was a white guy helping the Mexicans. But I had a tough cellmate at the time. He was an independent tough guy, and he intervened with the gang, and then they allowed me to continue doing those classes. And that got me in the good graces with that race. And the fact that I was learning Spanish as well, because it was half Hispanic where I was at, and I'd go and sit and talk with the Mexicans and the Mexican Americans, and they'd teach me Mexican and stuff like that.
You're smiling recounting that story. Are there any happy memories? Seems like
yeah, that
question,
was a happy memory. I mean, it's not a complete catalogue of horrors. There's a lot of gallows humour, and you do make friendships in there, and it's such an intense environment that you feel when you get out, no matter how much you tell people about it, no one can truly understand what you went through. But the guys you left behind, they know 100%, and some of them are still in there. A lot of them are still in there. A lot of people I bonded with. And I promised them when I got out, I would keep their stories going on the internet and my blog, because that became a bridge to the outside world for all of us. And they started to get letters and books, pen pals and things like that sent to them from people from around the world, from kind people. And that helped restore my faith in humanity after what I went through in the remand jail.
So you came back to England when you got released?
Yeah.
I'm guessing you can't go back to the USA at all, even if you wanted to.
I'm banned from America for life, me and Cat Stevens.
Would you want to?
You know, as much as people tried to hurt me over there, people came out of the blue like two Tonys to protect me. So I pushed America to its limits. America was good to me. I was very successful. I made a lot of money legally. And I overstepped boundaries that put me in prison. And if I could go back and do some talks to the school kids there, because I do yoga now and meditation, you know, perhaps that would restore my karma. But unless I get a presidential pardon, it's not going to happen anytime soon. And that takes at least a 7-figure political contribution these days to get a presidential pardon.
If you enjoyed that interview and the other 9 we've served you throughout this series, whether it be the recovering rock star or the celebrity Santa, why not buy us a beer to say thanks? You know the kind of show we're trying to make now, and I think it can get even better in Series 2. Loads of original, intimate, surprising interviews. But to do that, we need to research, travel, and take time off our other work. So if you can afford to pledge us a monthly amount, or choose your own amount as a one-off donation, just visit modernmanwith2ns.co.uk and click Beer Money. Thanks. And now, friends, for our final trip down the foxhole this series. Hello, Alex Fox.
Hello, Fizzbickle.
I would normally come straight in and say, you know, what sexy thing have you been up to this week? What's the latest weird vibrator that also plays your tune or something? But you just told me, and I can't let it go, that you were once on Ready, Steady, Cook. And
yes.
Now I need to ask you all about that instead.
Yes, I was. Green peppers. And I won.
Were you on as a celebrity contestant or as a pleb?
Was it heckers like, yeah. I was on as a normal person. I was still at university.
I was going to say students, the classic thing, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. I was 18 years old. I was studying at Leeds.
So actually, sorry, I should explain for listeners from other countries exactly what Ready, Steady, Cook is. It's a formatted daytime TV show in which two teams of cooks compete against the clock to create a dish based on the ingredients that are rather limited and supplied to them instantaneously on the set. There's real jeopardy there, Alex.
I tried excessively to be very laid back, even though I was incredibly nervous to be on TV. Yeah. And so I say, no probs to everything throughout. It's really cringy. Oh, hey, Ainsley. Yeah, I'll do that. No probs. Chop those herbs. No probs. I'm totally cooling down with this cooking thing.
And how was no Ainsley? So again, for listeners from other countries, Ainsley Harriott, I was going to say celebrity chef there, but I don't think he really cooks, does he? He's just basically a TV presenter that ended up on a cookery show. How was he in person?
Two outstanding factors. Number one is that Ainsley Harriott is enormous.
Really?
He is giant sized. Yeah, yeah. His hands have got, they're like, they could be best described as having a wingspan. He's an enormous human being, okay. Massive. Yeah. And also, I'll use the term cheeky. He said something extremely explicitly rude to me just before the cameras started rolling. And it's my theory, Ollie. I think he had some kind of bet going on with the other chefs where they'd say the most outrageous thing they could possibly think of just before filming started.
Yeah.
So that the contestants would suddenly have their eyes shooting out of their sockets and look shocked, which is exactly what you see when the camera pans to me.
Good God.
I did win, though. I won with my duck pancakes.
And is this great moment of daytime TV history available online for people to watch?
I think Mum's got it on a VHS tape somewhere. I did have a
the
green
YouTube
peppers.
Of the 90s. On to this week's question of sex then. It is from Brian, who says, I am a 60-year-old gay man in a long-term stable relationship. Over the last year or so, my erections haven't been as hard as they used to be. My partner, who is slightly older than me, has no such issues. While our sexual relationship is not overly penetrative, and I understand that this is part of the aging process, it does concern me. I'd like some advice, Alex, about Viagra or alternatives. While our relationship is relatively active for our age, I think, at about once a week, it's also spontaneous, so I don't like the idea of putting sex on hold while we wait for the Viagra to kick in. Is there anything else, particularly natural alternatives, that we could use?
Right, Brian. Brian wants natural alternatives to Viagra. I have three strata of suggestions as part of my answer. Mm-hmm. Viagra itself actually came out of patent in 2013.
Did so it?
Yes. Yeah.
So I could do my own brand of Viagra now if I wanted to?
Well, maybe not you.
I said could.
You could. It perhaps, you know, what are you going to put in it? Like a George's Marvelous Medicine of everything you found in the house and just hope it does magical things to people's
willies.
All right.
All I'm saying is that we could do Modern Man branded dick hardeners if we wanted to.
You could do. You could do, yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
If you wanted to make your own version of Modern Man Viagra, you would have to sildenafil chemical called sildenafil citrate, which is the medical name for Viagra. It's a form of PDE5 inhibitor, which increases blood flow to erectile tissue. However, there are other PDE5 inhibitors out there which work in similar but slightly different ways, which might suit Brian better. Mm-hmm. There's one, for example, called Cialis.
I've seen this advertised on American television. It's hilarious because it's all like men pushing their children on swings and stuff like that. You know how American drug adverts always are. It's a man enjoying a full life with his family, and then the voiceover kicks in and says, you know, everything's great in your life, but are you missing something? And then it makes no reference to the fact that this is a pill that actually makes your dick hard. But then there's like a good minute of all of the side effects that include death. But, you know, this is American legalese, isn't it? I'm sure you're fine if you take it.
There are potential side effects to almost all medications, and you absolutely need to speak to your GP. In fact, there are many reasons why a lot of people can't take Viagra. If you've got high blood pressure, for example, that can be
I remembered the line that it says that makes me laugh every time. If an erection lasts more than 6 hours, do consult your doctor. It's like the idea of that. It's horrifying, isn't it? You'd be knocking lamps out everywhere.
Or just go out into the street and twirl around naked going, I've had a 6-hour erection, I'm king of the world!
Yeah. Or just somewhere to put your brolly, I guess.
Well, the advantages that Cialis has over Viagra or Viagra equivalents are, for a start, that whilst you have to take Viagra about an hour before you want to have penetrative sex, you only have to take Cialis 30 minutes before. So
still a bit unspontaneous, isn't it? Brian is looking for a spontaneous solution here.
Well, it's designed for more spontaneous men specifically because he can also take a lower dose, say 2.5 to 5 milligrams every day on a daily basis. So it can help you over the long term. There are other more instantaneous medications, but the way that you take them is a little bit more... Well, I'm waiting for your facial expression, for you to rear away from your mic in horror. There are other meds that you can inject via syringe directly into your wanger, or you can use the equivalent of a cotton bud to feed them through the end of your pee hole. So they get the meds exactly where they need to be very quickly, but the method of delivery is perhaps a little wince-inducing.
I think I'd rather not ever have a stiffy again than start sticking cotton wool up there.
Okay.
Personally.
As far as other purported natural cures for erectile dysfunction go, I would advise Brian and his barge pole not to touch them with a barge pole, his own or anyone else's.
So what is the natural remedy that you would recommend?
Well, there's two. For a start, penis pumps. They're usually see-through tubes that you slide your bits into, and then they're either manually powered, so you kind of squeeze a little bulb that will increase the suction, or some of them are battery-powered as well.
Yeah.
The advantages of them are that you can use them just a few minutes before sex. They generally take about 6 minutes.
Extraordinarily unromantic, though, isn't it, to reach under the bed and get a pump out? I suppose you could make it part of the foreplay somehow.
It depends on how Brian and his partner approach sex. Yeah. They might actually be able to make it something quite sexy that they do together.
Yeah.
Alternatively, he can go into the bathroom for 12 minutes or whatnot, and it can be part of his getting ready routine. Admittedly, it's a little less subtle than popping a blue pill, but the advantages are that he doesn't have to put any medications in his body.
More fun watching it grow as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Like a seed, like a little plant.
I mean, like, you know, I don't like cycling, but I enjoy pumping up a tyre.
That's a really interesting insight into your psyche.
There's something therapeutic about it, you know, you feel like you're achieving something.
It's perhaps not very well known, but you can get certain types of penis pumps on the NHS.
Can you really?
Yes, you don't have to pay for them. If you're concerned that after you've used the pump, that the blood might just flow straight out of your penis and you'll lose your hard-on, some of them come with a little constriction band, like a cock ring, that you pop on the base of your penis to keep everything in place. You do need to be careful not to overdo them, otherwise they can damage the erectile tissue if you overstretch or overpump. So keep the pressure within a safe range.
It's like with an airbed, isn't it? You know, you can overpump an airbed, but then it'll explode.
It's really uncomfortable to sleep on a penis pump, though.
And your other recommendation of a natural remedy would be?
This is less a natural remedy and more a piece of equipment. And this is probably the most controversial, but Brian and his partner might find it useful. They seem quite young at the moment, but as they're getting older. Mm. And that is a strap-on, not only used by lesbians, also used by gay men and indeed straight men.
But he says relationship not overly penetrative. I suppose that means it's not the most important part of it to them.
No, which is why I'm thinking that he might enjoy or find it useful to use a strap-on harness when he does want to penetrate his partner. And indeed, when his partner wants to be penetrated by him.
Yes.
You would want to purchase something that was hollow, had a hollow strap-on phallus.
Why?
So that you can insert your own...
Oh, underneath?
Limb. Yeah, yes. You insert your own member into... Like, it's sort of like wearing an extra thick condom, really.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And then it's held on either using a special pair of pants that have a hole in the front that hold the phallus in place, or you can get a kind of harness, which a lot of people find quite sexy, you know, having the leather straps on them. And then you use it to make love to your partner as you would your own body. Advantages are you can essentially get fake hard instantly.
Yep.
You can put it on, take it off whenever you want to.
And it's funny to put it on your head and take a picture as well, isn't it? So you've got the comedy element too.
Two wonderful forms of pleasure for the price of just one.
Yeah, providing sexual relief and also comedy, as I feel we have done, Alex, throughout this series of The Modern Man. Thank you very much for all of your advice.
Oh, it's been lovely to speak to you.
If people have a question for the next series, then what do they need to do, Alex?
They need to head over to our website, which is modernman.co.uk, and fill out the feedback form.
And in the intermittent period, they can follow you on Twitter?
Yes, they can. I'm at Alex Fox, spelt with an I, not an E, so A-L-I-X-F-O-X.
Alex, it's been a pleasure.
It's been wonderful.
Do
Thanks
come
for
again.
Listening, everybody. Oh, I come every day.
And with that, this series is nearly at an end. Make sure you've subscribed to our feed. We will return in the spring. And you can support us in that by buying us a beer, or if you'd like to get in touch about sponsorship by filling in our feedback form, it's all on our website, modernman.co.uk. And by the way, anyone who's pledged us cash on a recurring basis, don't worry, we will pause your payments whilst we're on hiatus. You only ever get debited when we're delivering new content. If you can't afford to send us money, just post us a review on iTunes. Over 60 of you have given us 5-star reviews, of which we are immensely proud. Thank you. It's itunes.com/MANN. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, our theme music by Django Django, and this is by Mystery Jets. It's called Telomere, and it's from their new album Curve of the Earth, out January 15th on Caroline International. Thank you to everyone for downloading this series. We'll see you next term. Bye-bye.